Hello everyone and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. I'm Fiona Snickers and I'm joined by my co-host Gail Schimmel.
Hi Fiona.
Hi Gail, how has your writing week been?
So I have had to stop pretending to write 500 words a day because the time has come round again and I have a Katie Gale edit to do. Mm-hmm. So the Katie Gales, we write two a year. And the cycle tends to work that as one is about to come out, we are doing the edit for the next one.
Right.
So one has quite an intense time of it because you've got the new book. We're trying to start promoting the new book and I'm doing an edit for the next book. And we have a new editor, which is, of course, something that will also happen if you write enough for long enough in a particular series. So we got the edit letter. So you get a letter with the structural edit suggestions and a marked up manuscript. And it's because it's a new editor, it's a slightly different, there's a small adjustment. And as always, you read the editorial letter and you like that. So this is what will always happen if you are a writer that your editor likes and are precious to the publisher, but also you're human and you make errors. It will be a compliment sandwich. This book is magnificent. We were so happy to be back in the world of Berwick and so many good laughs. Very little to say. Can you just change the murderer, change where it happened, change who the murder weapon, blah, blah, blah. Lovely book. Sure you can manage this. And there's that moment where you're like, actually, we can't do any of that. We really can't. And I do the edits. And I had that moment badly, but in fact, it's a very small edit. It's a very gentle edit and I'm plowing through it and moving at pace and enjoying it. I do love doing edits once I get my head around them, but it has stopped me writing much. It's given me a lovely excuse not to write my own book. What about you, Fiona? What excuses are you using this week?
Well, I spoke last week about how a new idea has come to me and I wasn't sure whether it had legs and was going to go anywhere. And it's still sticking around. And I know why it came to me, because something in my real life sparked the idea. And I remembered previous incidents in my real life and I thought, this could be something. I could build this into something. And then I was thinking about these things that had happened in so-called real life and thinking that, well, they don't make such a neat story. They don't really have a great narrative arc, but maybe we could work with it. And I ended up in that tension that I think memoirists feel between what really happened and what would make a good story. And I had to remind myself that I'm not writing a memoir here. It doesn't matter what really happened. That can just be the fodder. It can be the inspiration for what you're going to write. But if you don't like what really happened, change it. Mm. This is fiction. Mm. You can reorganize it, rework it, while still keeping that original inspiration. So I've been stuck in that tension a bit and working things out between, you know, how good is the real life stuff and how much does it need to change? Mm.
You know, you put me in a great dilemma when you give little snippets like this. You like that person on Facebook going, it's been hard, but it will get better.
Yeah.
And I want to say, well, tell me, what is the real life thing? Let's unpack this. But also, I'm so private about my ideas that I'd hate it if you said to me, well, tell me, let's unpack it. So I don't even know what to say when you tell me a little kernel like that. But I do think that your attitude sounds right. Fictionalize it.
And speaking of fiction, Gail, what have you been listening or watching or paying attention to lately?
Well, I've been wanting to talk to you about this read because I know that one of the things you and I share is that we like a good witch book, but we're quite fussy about our witch books. We won't settle for just any old witch book.
Yes.
And I found a witch book that 90% has ticked my boxes for what I want from a witch book, and it is called A Resistance of Witches by Morgan Ryan.
Right.
And she has written this book, I think it's a debut, about witches helping in the war effort in World War II.
Oh.
And you know, I'm not a big one for historical novels, and I since I've had children, I've been unable to read a lot of World War II fiction because Hitler would have killed my children. It doesn't bother me that he would have killed me, but my children bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
But this one I felt was far enough away from reality that I'd be able to deal with it. And indeed, and it's fun. It's about a coven of witches, that they've been secret in their world, but they go to Churchill and they say they will assist. And then we pick up the story a little bit into the war, and something has gone wrong, and there is a powerful magical book that the Nazis are looking for, and the witches have to stop them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the premise. And it's made me think a lot about what is it I want from a witchy book? Like, what are the magic ingredients for a witchy book for me?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think yours are?
For me, and I've also thought about this a lot, I don't want to be in an entirely magical world. Mm-hmm. High fantasy is not my thing, but witches are a little bit my thing. So I want the world to be real and everyone else to be ordinary. And I want the witch and maybe some other people in her family or some friends or whatever, they can be magical, but they must be the exceptions. They must be trying to navigate the everyday world.
Mm.
And when you've got that kind of those magical ingredients, I am in. I want to read that book.
Okay, that's interesting because I'm happy. Yeah, I think I agree. I'm happy for there to be a world of witches,
mm-hmm.
but I also, I have read and enjoyed a number of high fantasy books where that is the world, but I like that level of secrecy, I think, that
yes.
level of, and I also love a discovery of power. I didn't get book, but I do love a coming of age witch story where she discovers whether it's now or late in life, whether it's young or late in life, that she has these magical powers. I like that.
Yes, yes, me too. That's the Harry Potter
yes.
when the glass disappears and he lets the snake out, that
yes.
kind of moment.
Yes, that moment.
That
is
can be a lot of fun.
Very much. I enjoy that a lot. Do you think you'd ever, you've written, I was about to say, do you think you'd ever, but you have. You've written a Witch Cozy series. Was it fun?
It was a lot of fun, and every now and again I'm tempted to go back to it because it does give me that sort of lovely feeling. But... yeah, as I've said before, I fear that AI is coming for the witch cozies and that AI can just grab those tropes and make them what we used to make them. And so I want to go in a different direction.
You know, Fiona, I don't believe it because I've been thinking about this a lot. And I think that in those witch cozies, in ordinary cozies, in any genre book, that the magic actually lies in the small detail.
Mm-hmm.
And the magic lies in the little joke and the quirky Easter eggs, and I don't think AI can do that. So I think that while AI could write a perfectly readable book, you know, mm-hmm. it won't be awful. It mm-hmm. will be perfectly readable. I still think there's going to be the human writing is going to stand out. I really do.
Yeah, I'm more of a pessimist and you more of an optimist. I hope that you are right. That's all I can say. I want to live in a world where you are right about this.
I'm always right. My husband will tell you. What about you, Fiona? I've talked a lot about witches. What have you been reading, watching, doing?
I've been reading, and because you are my guru and I follow you in all things, I decided to start reading Wally Lamb because I'd never read him before.
Yes.
And I conscientiously Googled, what is Wally Lamb's best book? And I got the response, I know this much is true. So I downloaded it on my Kindle. I bought it sight unseen. And then I saw that it was 1,000 pages long. So I thought, oh, okay, gulp. I've set myself a bit of a task here. And I read it and it is magnificent, especially looking back on the whole thing, having finished it as a product. It is magnificent. But there were times while I was reading it that I was almost dreading going back to it because it is such a traumatic story. And he doesn't shy away from the horror and the trauma. He lives in it. Mm-hmm. And there were times when it was a really hard read.
It's funny because I never remember that about Wally Lamb, but it is, I think, true of all his books. He does not shy away from enormous trauma and difficult subjects, and the latest book as well. I think I read I Know This Much Is True when I was much younger
mm-hmm.
and psychologically more robust. You know, I think in your 20s and early 30s, you have a protective layer almost. Mm. You're not as vulnerable to the hurt of the world because you're not as, I don't know, aware that the world is basically rotten. Did you just say I'm the optimist and you're the pessimist? But yeah, he is hard, but you'll read another one, won't you?
I will read another one. I'll probably read the most recent one now because that's what I was very curious about. But it was a great recommendation. He is a brilliant natural writer. Brilliant. He is just inspired.
Mm.
And I'm so happy to have been introduced to him.
I'm glad to hear it.
So somebody else who does not shy away from trauma and the difficult things in life is our guest today. Our guest today is Claire Robertson, who's joining us from Australia. Claire is the author of The Spiral House, The Magistrate of Gower, Under Glass, Isle, and now most recently, The Immortalites, which is published by Penguin Random House. Claire won the Sunday Times Fiction Prize for her debut novel, The Spiral House. She also won a South African Literary Award and was shortlisted for the University of Johannesburg Debut Prize. Claire, we're very excited to be chatting to you today. Hello and welcome.
Hi, I'm so grateful to you for inviting me. Thank you.
And this is quite exciting for us because I don't think we've ever spoken to anyone quite so far away from us before, have we, Fiona? Do you want to tell the listeners where you are?
I'm in the very easternmost part of Sydney, Australia.
You know how we start. I think we talked about it before we started recording. So please tell us, how has your writing week been?
I'm not writing at all at the moment. I've decided to do this risky and very frightening thing and attempt an Australian novel, Australian historical literary fiction novel, -. And so, I mean, the sheer cheek of that has me researching so hard at the moment. And Australia being a previously colonial society is just like South Africa. People write far too much about themselves. The Victorians went nuts doing that. So there's a lot to wade through till you get the really good stuff. And fortunately, I found one of those recently, called The Colony. But when I put down, I just had me bursting into tears. It was just so sad, the history of what's gone down here. But that's all I'm doing. So I'm not writing. What I suspect, though, is there's a chance that all my deep dive into Australian history is actually what I call writing avoidance technique number three. It used to be when I had access to my lovely woodworking studio, I would make something that I absolutely had to have before I could start writing the new book, a new lap table or a little desk or something that, you know, just had to be worked on until I actually couldn't fool myself anymore and just would have to get down to the writing. So this might be writing avoidance, but it's fairly daunting stuff what I'm learning. It is, you would think colonial history, but it's quite different to the history I know, which is South Africa.
Sure.
And when you are in the thick of actually writing a novel, what does your daily process look like? Can you break that down for us?
Yeah, I can tell you what it has looked like. Circumstances have changed a bit. I had a lovely job in South Africa. It was 4 days a week and started at sort of 9 o'clock in the morning. So I did followed the advice of give the best of your day to your writing.
Mm.
So I would get up very early and write and just feel so good about myself after finishing those 1,000 words. I'm employed at the moment by a New Zealand company. I picked up a job in New Zealand and have kept it here. And there's a time difference. So I start work at 7 o'clock.
Wow.
With them. Yeah. So, but I'm thinking I could possibly make myself in summer at least get up at 5:30. I only need an hour in the morning. But the alternative is writing in the afternoon. And I'm just brain dead.
Yeah.
When you reach me in the afternoon.
She says from the afternoon.
Yeah, afternoon, Australia. When I started, I was the complete cliche. I had a Moleskin Cahier, the beautiful big notebook that they have, which is 60 pages of beautifully spaced lines. I had the right pen, I had the right lap desk, and it was immensely satisfying to fill up those books. I haven't been entirely on doing the thing in longhand for a while. although it's partial. I've noticed that I don't write so well anymore. I'm just getting more and more used to the keyboard.
Yeah.
And my writing is getting quite hard to decipher when I'm done with it. I don't know what's that to do with whether there's some neurological problem I should be aware of. I think it's just not using my writing very much. But what that did, which I miss a bit, is you're forced to do a fairly good, close read very early on in the process. So you write the novel out, and there, the matter of putting in, deletions are very quick, putting in notes is very quick, which are not very quick on a keyboard. And then you have to input the book. And while you're inputting it, you're doing a lovely edit, quite a close edit of the book.
And how does that work for you? Do you write your 1,000 words in the morning and then that day input that? Or do you write the whole book in longhand? How does that work?
Whole book in longhand.
Sure.
And then try to, whatever break I can afford, try to have a bit of a break between writing and then the first, or the second draft, I suppose it is. It's sort of a first-ish, second-ish draft. But that gap is the best thing, as you know, getting away from the manuscript for a while. And I proved that with The Immortalites. I had a gap of nearly a year, a very tumultuous year of emigrating for the first time to New Zealand about 3.5 years ago, setting up in tiny little town in rural New Zealand where I knew nobody. I had a brother in the country, and he would come down, was very kind, he and his wife, but no one in the town. And that sort of alienated me sufficiently from the manuscript, which is what you want to do. You want to try to come to the thing clean, as you know. And I think that helped with the writing of The Immortalites. But yeah, it would be a morning full, you know, push the book out and then get on with the day and not think about it, not look at it at night at all. Maybe if I was feeling generous to myself, make a little note for how I should start the next morning. And I also had a ritual that involved, it's coming back to me now, but a lovely poetry anthology. I think it's the Oxford Book of Verse or something, lovely fat one, that's arranged chronologically. So if I was writing in 1785, I would go to the 1780s and start my writing day with reading a poem from that era. And the poets are the geniuses of what we do. They're just so good, the way that they deal with language. And that would set me off.
I'm so interested in your process. We're going to not let you go on the process stuff for a while.
Yay.
So you said you write your 1,000 words. You kind of said that in passing. Is that what you make yourself do? Is the 1,000 words the measure, or is it when your time is up and normally that is about 1,000 words? And also, how do you count words when you're writing in longhand in a notebook?
Yeah, I counted up and worked out what was the average, a little obsessive average. So it would be 4 of those foolscap pages. And it would be 4 pages I would have to do. And I've found recently when I'm writing on a laptop, which I now do, it's usually about 800 words seems to be my sweet spot.
And do you make yourself push to 1,000 or you stop at the 800?
No, I can stop at 800 if I need to. I'm not. Who was it, Trollope or Thackeray, who made himself do 2,000 every day, and if he finished a book, he would start the next book to make up the word count in the middle of it. But that's just weird.
Claire, I want to go back to your secret origin story. I remember when I came onto the literary scene in South Africa in about 2009, I remember you as a journalist and somebody who was very much in the literary scene. And then your first novel, The Spiral House, seemed to come out of nowhere, and it made a very, very big splash when it landed in 2013. Had you always wanted to be a fiction writer? Were you that little child who wanted to write fiction, or where did that come from? Had you always been secretly writing fiction, or did you make a sort of big change from journalism to fiction?
I kept a diary when I was younger, from about the age of 16, and I loved it. I loved writing that. So that might have been part of it. But I remember when I was about 13, discovering that there was such a job as journalism in the world, and just thinking, that's the life for me. We were a very reading family. Everyone always had their nose in a book, and me almost more than the rest of them. I would lie upside down if I got uncomfortable and continue reading. I'd walk reading. My parents would come in at night, and they said it was really spooky. They'd switch the light off, and then I'd be fast asleep in bed with a book propped up in front of me. Freakish. But it wasn't. The writing was going to be journalism, was just how you did it. And probably, I was fairly practical, probably I knew that I could support myself that way, and just think I could with fiction. But it started to pall a bit because, I mean, the bumper sticker could be you're dealing with facts but not with the truth in journalism. And in fiction, you're dealing with made-up facts, and it had better ring true. It really has to be that way. I'm trying to think. There was the thing I used to trot out at the book festivals. Nelson Mandela was released from prison, high point of lots of journalists' careers. And then after about a year, the ANC, which was very good at using him for marketing purposes, hosted a big press trip back to Robben Island to photograph him in his cell. And I went along with it. And it was horrendous being a part of that melee of foreign correspondents, very aggressive, especially television journalists, and pushing and shoving, literally shoving you out of the way so that they can get the shot. Later, I was a television journalist and I worked out, you do have to do that. But I remember one moment we went to the quarry, which had robbed him of most of his eyesight, or a lot of his eyesight. This tall, dignified, beautiful man, you know, picking away at this limestone. And there was a cordon and there was a ring of press, and at some distance away from us was Madiba, and people were getting their shots off, and the voice rang out, "You do a dance for us, Mr. Madiba," Mr. Mandela. Yeah. And he just, he sort of skipped a tiny beat and lifted his arms up and shuffled into Shoshaloza, doing this dance because it was good for the movement to do the dance or something. And I just got the hell in, and I went back, and it was on a Saturday. I had to file for the Sunday Times, and I filed that story, not, you know, in an historic move, Nelson Mandela yesterday returned to Robben Island. Not that story, which was the untrue one, but what had really happened, that he was kind of becoming this cipher and this theatrical act that we could roll out. And he was participating in it. And that I really do think, although it sounds a bit too pat, that the experience of doing that started switching something in my mind. Anyway, it was a fascinating story, and I was still covering that. So segued into television because I thought that was interesting. Oh, no, sort of tried magazines. Listened to television. And then just kind of stopped cold. I was old enough. My two daughters were getting ready to fly the nest. I can't quite work out the sequence of events. I got very ill then, or I first did this and then I got very ill. And I just decided I'm not selling my writing anymore in the service of journalism. I'm not going to make my penny that way. Fortunately, there are lots of jobs in journalism. One of them is sub-editor, so you're fixing up other people's writing. So I switched, got off the greasy pole of ambitious junior Miss Executive television jobs, and just became a sub-editor. Then I think got very ill, sort of life-threatening illness, got better, kids moved out of home, voila, started to write.
When you told us at the beginning about what your writing week, and you talked about doing that research, and it's one of the things that, one of the many things that would intimidate me about historical fiction, that the amount of research. How did you even begin? Do you begin with, you know, what period you want to write about, or do you just dive in and hope something grabs you? How do you go about that research?
I can talk a bit about where the various books originated, and I think the answer is somewhere in there. Spiral House, one of the television stories I did that I was proudest of was for special assignment to do with AIDS in Brighton Township in Port Elizabeth, Gqeberha. My main contact and source there was a brilliant demographer, academic called Robert Shell, who, when he was younger, had written a book called Children of Bondage, which was the history of slavery in South Africa. And it had never really occurred to me that there was a history of slavery in South Africa. As an African nation, we were importing slaves. I mean, there's nothing that this country does right way around, even slavery. And I started reading about that, and that's where I gravitated to when I wanted to write something. So that one came from, gosh, I wonder what would have happened if. And then I knew that the time it should happen was there was a historian I loved a chap from history that I love to read, François Levelon. I have a sort of side project, which is an interest in history, the history of sex in South Africa. And Levelon features in that he named a bird, the Narina Trogon, after a young Xhosa maiden that he said was desperately in love with him. He didn't say he loved her. He said, no, she was so in love with me, this Narina. Anyway, and he was someone I was interested in. He was of the age of enlightenment, so that became the period that I would use. What was the next one? Magistrate of Gower was just what would happen if you were a gay chap in the Boer War. I don't know why that came up. and I remember very clearly the Under Glass book, which is set in Victorian Natal, I was watching an adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, and Mrs. Bennet was going on about, you wouldn't be so funny if you had five daughters to marry off. And I thought, you know, the people I come from are a lot more ruthless than that. We would have made a plan. And then the whole book is about a woman making a plan. And it has a very handy sort of analogy for that thing. I have no idea where it came from because it's medieval Germany and post-World War II North Sea. Can't answer that one. and then I think, are we up to the Immortalites?
Yes.
Immortalites. When I was briefly at Rhodes University, I used to think it was the funniest thing in the world to go and visit my three greats grandfather in the local 1820 Settler Museum, where he sort of glowered from this photograph. Nice looking chap, but very glowery. And he had written a diary, kept a diary, which I loved. But the part I mostly loved about it was in it, there was a code for every time he got lucky. And it was four dots in a square and a dot in the middle. But literally, one of the academics had worked out that this was the... So I almost eluded the fact that buried in there, that he doesn't talk about, but that the person who edited the diaries does talk about, was the horrific death of his little daughter, who was the first of my line to be born in South Africa, was killed and stuffed into an animal hole, either termite mound or hyena. And that has sort of stayed in the back of my mind. And then my brother, the one in New Zealand, retired, bought a Land Rover and set about photographing every known elephant in South Africa and traveling around. And he got to Addo. Yeah, no way, it does link up. He got to Addo and we were sort of chatting. I said, no, wait, hold on, I'm coming. And when I flew out and joined him, and we went to try and find what we could of the family story. And we found it was the most thrilling thing. It was like your veins turning to fire. We found this gravestone of the little girl. And it's a murder stone. Murder stones are quite rare. Murder stones that allude to the method of death of the person lying there. And so said this is barbarously murdered by A, and then the unforgivable word on this thing had been broken off at the terrible word, had been reinscribed. There it was, sitting there. And I thought, I can't write a novel about this. I can't. It's too much, too painful. But I remember my brother and I doing sort of detective work around the graveyard in Cumber, and both of us saying, this isn't what happened. That's not how the world worked then. We don't know who did, and we didn't want to say specifically that we thought it was one of the people she might have known. Anyway, that started sparking it. And then another graveyard near my home in Simonstown in those days. I used to go there to collect names because there are no names as beautiful as the ones you see on. In fact, I live near a cemetery here too. A pattern is developing. And there was this lovely little name, Ellen Kent, which is just such a brisk, upright little name. And the initials spell out Eck. So it was just lovely. And I used her and she kind of swept me along on that story. So the origins are, I've always thought that the origin, that writing a book and coming up with the ideas for a book is exactly the same part of your brain that produces dreams at night. So some idea pops up, you go through absolute pretzel-like contortions to make that thing that popped up logical, to fit it into a narrative. And then it starts to tell you why that popped up, what you really care about in that story. And that all happens subconsciously. And I do think with the addition of a laptop or a pencil in hand, that's what you're dealing with. And of course, because you have, the pencil puts this in my mind, because you have to then put it into language and written language, you lose 90% of whatever you were aiming for. But you are left with some kind of story to tell your monkey cousins, you know.
I wanted to ask about the experience of having your first novel do so extremely well, to win 2 major awards for it and be nominated for a third. It's lightning in a bottle. You've come out of nowhere. It's done exceptionally well. And now you've got to sit down and write the second book. Mm. Did you have any kind of sophomore syndrome, any doubt about whether you'll be able to make lightning strike twice, or did you just, it sort of gave you the wind beneath your wings to sort of have the confidence to go forth and write more books? What was that experience like?
Well, I had nothing to compare it to. I didn't know how crazy it was. I've since learned that it was. The awards were, it's incredibly stressful to win an award. Oh, whoa, poor pitiful me. But it is. It makes you crazy. There's magical thinking involved, all sorts of things. One of the people talking about the book had said it had taken me 20 years to write or something. And I was just so stung by that. My journalistic self was so stung by that. Of course it hadn't. It's taken 2 or 3. So I roared into writing The Magistrate of Gower, which was finished, I think, 18 months after Spiral House came out. Pushed through it. I think Magistrate of Gower is a better book than Spiral House. I have a very soft spot for it, possibly because it relates quite closely to sort of family history, very recent family history, to do with breakups and stuff. I was very into the theory of what it meant to write a book, because I over-researched everything, probably poor self-esteem or something like that involved in it. And people had spoken about the sophomore syndrome. So I was determined not to let that happen. You know, I wouldn't,
That's very interesting. I'm also interested that it has such a place in your heart, because I think there is something about a second book, that a second book is the proof that you're a writer. I almost feel like almost anyone, if they sit down and work hard, could produce one book, but it's when you produce the second book that you're a writer.
It absolutely felt like that, that I had some sense of what I was about, what needed to happen, what the book needed from me, and more professionalism involved in it. Mm. I knew to look forward to the editing process, which I hadn't known the first time I was edited, how very dare they edit me kind of thing. Although I had the best. Guess who I had as my first editor? Was Essie Nordier, Fani Nordier.
Oh, wow.
The great writer, yeah, mm. Alphabet chap. Yeah, he was brilliant. I think his longest note was, we're over-egging the pudding a bit here, don't you think? He knew how to get me. Oh, my God. stating something outright, never banish it. Anyway, yeah, it really is. And setting out, knowing kind of having an idea of what you're about, yeah, and pushing through and doing it.
Yeah. Tell us about your research process, because you said you're busy researching a, novel based in Australia now. Has your research process changed from book to book? Do you primarily go into the primary sources? So are you spending your days in archives, digging up old letters and diaries and what have you, or primarily secondary sources, people who've written about this period? Both. How has it changed? How has it evolved? How is it different doing it for Australia? Just talk us through all that.
In the beginning, it was a secondary source, but the best secondary source, Children of Bondage, Robert Shelbrook. And then I did a tour of the archives in the Cape, and they showed the slave records. I think I was there on a story or something. Just seeing the slave records so neatly written out was just chilling and wonderful. So I knew that I should go to the primary source a bit more. It varies so much book to book. Isle, the medieval Beguine convent side of things, I went off to Dizzy Bodenburg in near Hildesheim on the Rhine, and stayed in a convent for a while and went walking around the ruins of the abbey, which was lovely. And I think if I could do that, I would with everyone, but there isn't always enough of the world left to explore. The Immortalites, as I say, went and found the graveyard, and my grandfather's diary, which I've always had. And there are lots of lovely little museums all over the Eastern Cape. And there you get this lovely, rich source of, because people want to write of their lives. And so somewhere between the primary and secondary source is this sort of cottage industry of sometimes punishingly dull accounts of people's lives, and sometimes just so quirky and strange and wonderful. You're really into people and how they thought and felt in those days. The Australian one, Sydney is a big, stonking, very impressed with itself kind of city, and it is impressively beautiful as well. But a lot has disappeared, but there's quite a lot remaining of these magnificent sandstone buildings and historical homes that you can visit. And then get a sense that what you're seeing is a little bit more of a hymn of praise to itself than what actually went down. But that's what the novel's for. So, yeah.
Claire, you've touched on as you've spoken that about your move from South Africa to New Zealand to Australia. And I'm interested in it because your books are about journeys often. You know, your characters are often involved in a big journey, and then you've taken this big journey. Can I ask you what made you rip up your life like that? Or is, you can say no if you don't want to answer.
It's a three-word answer, Zadie Elsa Eldridge. So that is the name of my granddaughter. So some while back, my firstborn went off to New York on a lovely sort of fellowship thing, where she met a lovely Australian, brought him back to South Africa. They got married and they moved to Sydney, which was fine. I could cope with that. Other daughter was in London. And then Helen and Felix, the Australian ones, had a baby. And I was like a salmon swimming upstream. I had to get to this little kid. It really was crazy. I had to both get to see Zadie, but almost more importantly, get to see Helen as a mother. Mm. So this all happened during COVID. You cannot believe what I went through to see this baby, and eventually did see her during COVID, spending time in what amounted to a prison camp. Then went back home and thought, oh, that's it, I have to go. Now, my father was born in Christchurch in New Zealand, left when he was very young, when he was a kid, so for South Africa. But because he was born, we had citizenship if we wanted it. It's quite hard and quite expensive to get otherwise. So I thought, well, I'll go off to New Zealand because it's easy entry. Went off, established this thing, wrote two books. I was so isolated in this little rural New Zealand town. Wrote The Immortalites and wrote another medieval German. I laugh at myself for those medieval German books. Wrote another one of those, which is sort of sitting, waiting, tapping its fingers. And then it worked out. They changed the law in Australia, and it worked out that I was acclimatized, I think. And I emigrated again about a year and a bit ago, year and a half ago, maybe, to to Australia, and I would not recommend emigrating twice in 2 years, which is what I did. It is so discombobulating. Although it helped when I finally found my analogy, which is you've been given a keyboard that is different from the keyboard you're used to using. So you can't touch type anymore when you're an immigrant. You can still type, but it's hunt and peck, and you keep remembering where the keys used to be. So you stutter the whole way through. Anyway, once I found the neat way of packaging it in words, it made it a lot easier.
So you can say to yourself, all that's happening now is I'm looking for the right place in the keyboard.
Yeah, yes, exactly. I'm not touch typing. That's not such a big deal. And then the little baby's name is Zadie Elsa Eldridge, and I love being a grandmother so much. And I have lucked into a most wonderful life here. On where I live is along this cliff that really is the eastern edge of Australia. Huge cliffs. Yesterday we saw a whale off the cliffs. The other day it was 5 kookaburras. Kookaburras are so fantastic. They're enormous. They're really big. They're like bigger than kingfishers. Yeah. And do cackle like maniacs. And I have been back to South Africa twice. In that period, once for a wedding, my youngest daughter, and once to the gathering of all the siblings to bury my mum. And the first time was weddings are out-of-body experiences, so that doesn't count. But the recent one, which was in February, left me quite shaken about South Africa because I found it unbearably vivid. Just so everything was, excuse the pun, black and white and either the sweetest smile you've ever seen in your life or a feeling of risk and threat. Bright, crazy colors, beautiful people, wonderful music, but a cacophony, traffic that's a bit frightening. So I obviously was going through something in that experience of South Africa. And honestly, I just told myself, just calm down. You're lucky to come from such an interesting place.
So interesting.
It is. Claire, you mentioned COVID, and I have noticed a trend among writers that the book they brought out during COVID is sometimes a little bit different to the rest of their work, sometimes a little bit allegorical, a little bit out of time, out of space, out of time, universal. I'm thinking of Karen Jennings's The Island. I'm thinking of Joanne Fedler's latest book. They strange little isolated allegories, often shorter than the normal books that these authors bring out.
What you're describing is The Immortalites, shorter, allegorical. Why is Isle different? Isle is a disturbed book. There's something going on there that I don't quite get. I love the Beguine part of it. The Mechthild and her story. I just did something about that. I love discovering that there was this movement of women who lived not a cloistered life, but lived in a communal life. And that was the way they were allowed to not be married and not be nuns. So they were people making a plan to build themselves a life. And it opens up so many stories. The story that is languishing at the moment, which is also Mechthild again, she has to defend an ox who's accused of murder. Which did happen in medieval Germany, medieval lots of places. But the first part, the second part, the 1945 or 48 part, I don't understand that book, where it came from, why I wrote it.
Did you write it during lockdown?
No, okay. I didn't write anything. I wrote The Immortalites during lockdown, yeah. So I wrote it during lockdown. I was talking earlier about having a break from your manuscript and how valuable it is. Wrote this in South Africa, had this immensely traumatic, good and bad ways, break. Picked it up again in New Zealand, finished it. Did an edit, had another break, and did the last edit while I was in Australia, all long distance, which is quite an experience, long distance publishing. I wouldn't have thought that it would have made much difference, but it did.
I felt quite remote. Talk us through that. Why
I felt a bit remote. Well, a couple of things had happened. I'd had the same publisher the whole way through, Furi Buerta, the great, at Umuzi, and he left. And he became my agent very briefly. It's the first time and last time I've had an agent. Anyway, and then he stopped doing that, so that didn't happen either. So I had a new publisher, new editor. I had all these feelings of loyalty to Fourie, and now I was dealing with his replacement, who ended up being the most wonderful editor, Jaco Adrianza, who's now, I think, I'm sure there's no causative relation at all, but is now in charge of everything at Umuzi. Well, he's the English, I think he's the fiction editor now, head of fiction, something like that. And I had a good experience with it, but far away, I don't know, it felt weird. You never get to walk past an exclusive books and see your book. And this is the first time they've ever given me a little display. It's like a till display thing, apparently, which I'll never see. It was quite a schlep to get readers' copies out here. So I didn't see it for ages. And just, I don't know, just a sense of not being there to welcome the little thing. It's by itself out there in the world. But I think if I try to go through an Australian publishing process, I'm going to be longing for the long distance one. It's quite daunting. We'll see how that goes. Yeah.
Let's talk about your use of language in your books, because from The Spiral House onwards, you were in a way defamiliarizing language in the way that you were using it. And some people loved it, and some critics found it so strange that they didn't know what to make of it. And now in The Immortalites, you're really leaning into that. It's a sentence that is constructed in an unfamiliar way.
Okay.
You know, we in the 21st century are used to quite simple, short declarative sentences. And this book is not set now. It's set in the past. And it reminds me of diaries and books that come from that era when people spoke and thought and wrote differently. And you've really leaned into that now. And to me, it works very well because it takes one out of today and really shoves you into the past and reminds you that the past is a foreign country and they're doing things very differently there.
So the first book, Spiral House, there are two books in it. One is a sort of straightforward-ish 1961 book, and then there's the slave narrative from 1794. And I think it's first person, that one. So she had to be 17 years old. All these layers had to work for me, for Katrin. She had to be 17 years old, had been a slave, but was now freed, bright as a button, aware of being bright as a button, and also aware of telling her story. So there was formality and it needed to flicker across, the language needed to flicker and be sort of dappled around her. And I think that broke something in my brain, because then I started writing like that about other things as well. But we worked so hard to make them, why I was pulling faces, we worked so hard to make The Immortalites not be that like that, to be really a much easier read. Have no highfalutin Victorian language, Georgian language, sorry, I'm Victorian, yes. I don't know, I think it is easier and simpler. One of the things we did, which she said, scurrying away from talking about language, I worked out that with like 40 years as a journalist under my belt, I was used to writing in a certain way. Mm. And one of the ways that I was writing to and had got away with it for was that the columns in newspaper stories are very narrow, so it's easy for the eye to read.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when there's a wider one, it's called a bastard set column, and it's frowned upon. So we, Jaco and I, worked on setting The Immortalites on a much narrower page, which you can, okay, there's only about 9 or 10 words per thing, to make it a bit easier to understand. The language thing, I think, it feels a lot like acting, this writing thing sometimes, assuming roles and putting words into things' mouths. And it's just adopting an accent. And I wish that I didn't do it quite as much as I do it, although it does bring reward. You do sometimes just come up with phrases that you just fall in love with because of playing with language in that strange kind of aslant way.
Claire, would you describe yourself as a feminist writer? Is there a feminist agenda at work in your books, and has that changed over the years? Because I think there is, but I'm not sure how deliberate and intentional it is.
Well, it's not something I can ever get away from. It's bred in the bone. I'm feminist to my core. It's feminist for which read humanist. So, but it's interesting you ask that, because with the Immortalites, I don't know what to do with this anger, this woman anger about men, like men. But, and the Immortalites, Ellen Kent is really done quite badly by men. But and in the book, there is a woman suffering at the hands of pompous, arrogant, dishonest, warlike, violent, all sorts of things that the men are in that book. But she overcomes that, and she finds absolute sublime joy in, and she talks about it right at the end, being an immigrant or being a colonizer, or I think a settler in South Africa. She says something like, it was like loving men in that you couldn't, well, I've got to find it. If I can read you a little bit, if that's okay.
Please do.
And I began to know what other matters had been decided for me by my hind mind. In a sort of likewise, I asked for benevolence and a welcome from this place, though I and my kind had done everything to not deserve it. And I would love a man, though as a type their crimes against me were many. I would seek a home in a place we were doing everything to alienate ourselves from, and make my closest husband from that alien clay. In neither of these was I invoking exceptionalism to make sense of it. That would have been a slight of morality. No, I committed myself to a conscious and often unconscious accommodation with it, to recognize the freight and hypocrisies and then to ignore them. Call it love. So, yeah, she, both in the journey of the Ellen Kent character and in the shape of the book, there's magic. And I was saying to someone the other day, when magic comes knocking when you're writing a book, you loosen your corsets and you let it, sink a bit into it. And I didn't ask too many questions. And it really is, Fiona, I did not know that about books written in COVID or written during lockdown. It is exactly, this is that book. And it's strange, and it had puzzled me, but I love that it's part of a syndrome.
It's just something that I've observed. Claire, we always like to ask our guests what they have been reading or watching or listening to lately that's made an impression on them.
Well, as I say, I've been reading mainly history books about early Australia. And I'm now reading On the Origin of Species by Charles Darwin, which is lovely. It's actually charming. So not much fiction. When I got here, I delved back into Australian writing. I love Peter Carey. I loved Oscar and Lucinda when I was younger. So I couldn't believe that there was this whole Peter Carey I never even heard of and just was out there. And she said, I think if you stick around, you might find quite a few Peter Careys that you've never heard of that you just have to read. A lovely sense of that. Oh, she probably didn't speak like that at all. But, yeah. So novels, not too many. The reward that I give myself of watching a little bit of the box after a hard day of sub-editing agricultural journalism and reading Australian history. I came across, when you're spoiled for choice, which you are in this huge, rich country for what to watch, you end up watching crap usually. But the other day I just came across something I want everyone to watch, is The Death of Stalin, the movie. And book-wise, one of the things I do when I'm in this sort of water, because you can't stay away from literature for too long, is I start rereading. So I'll go back to old favorites. I probably am going to read The Siege of Krishnapur any day now, because that's my favorite book in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know it at all, J.G. Ballard?
No.
Indian Mutiny. Oh, it's really worthwhile. It's a wonderful book.
I love that you have a favorite book, that you are very clear that you have a favorite book.
Well, I kind of have two. There's that one, and there's Hotel du Lac by Anita Bruckner. A perfect book. Yeah.
That used to be one of my rereads.
Well, Claire, we hope that everyone checks out The Immortalites, published by Penguin Random House. It's available in bookstores right now, and it is fascinating and brilliant. And if there's anyone left in South Africa who has not read your fiction, I hope they go back and check it all out, because it very much rewards scrutiny and revisiting. So thank you so much for your time. This has been great.
It's been so much fun. Thank you, guys.
Gail, every now and then we get a writer that we speak to who really seems to gel with our way of thinking. Mm. And for me, I feel like Claire Robertson was that person.
Absolutely. So much of what she said was so interesting to me, although she writes very different books from certainly from what I write, maybe a little bit closer to you, but very different from you. And her language use is different and all those things. But still, it's interesting how that writing experience is still, there's something shared.
Absolutely. There really is.
So what did you notice in particular that resonated with you?
I loved what she said about when she's trying to embed herself in a certain historical era, that she reads the poetry from that era. Because we've had people tell us that they look at the art, or they listen to the music, or they find some other way to bed themselves into this fictional world that they're going to participate in. But the idea of reading that poetry, that really resonated for me. I'd love to try doing that.
And I think for historical fiction particularly, it's interesting because it is about the language use of the day. And so it gets your head into the right language use space and the thinking like the people of that time thought. So I thought it, I mean, I'm never going to write historical fiction, so it is not a practical hint for me. But I found it really, really interesting.
Yes, yes, me too. And what did you take from it?
Well, I think she might have answered your problem.
Mm-hmm.
You started out this today talking about the problem of having an idea from real life and how much do you fictionalize it. And she talked about that when you write fiction, you're dealing with made up facts, but it needs to ring true.
Yes.
And I think maybe that's the thing to remind yourself, to take that ring of truth that comes from the real life inspiration.
Yes.
But it's made of facts. And that's where fiction and real life come together, that we write what we know in terms of feelings.
Yes.
But not in terms of fact.
Yes, that the truth, the sense of truth derives not from historical accuracy or factual accuracy, but from a certain feeling of something being true in a fictional way. Yes, I like that. I'm going to use that as I'm sort of formulating this book in my head. I like that very much. So if any of our listeners have read The Immortalites or anything else by Claire Robertson, she's been publishing for a long time now and is greatly and justly celebrated in the South African literary scene, please get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. We're on all social media across the board.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.